I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices from what was a busy week in the news.
I am confident that expanding Medicaid and offering health insurance to New Hampshire's poorest adults is the single most important step we can take to improve the health and security of our population while making an unparalleled investment in our economy and jobs.
He has a delivery problem. He has a backlog of deliveries, and we need him to have a plan in place to respond to that. We need him to have working phones so that people can make contact and call when they're having difficulties, and he just needs to get caught up. He needs to get these tanks filled and to get people's heat back on.
It's really a small increase, considering that what the state pays now per charter school student is less than half of the state average. But just having that funding there just really makes it possible to be sustainable.
It's very exciting when you wake up and you get coffee orders from Portland, Oregon, or Seattle, Washington. These coffee meccas are coming, you know, to a roaster in New Hampshire.
Now he's shopping for a Senate seat in New Hampshire. Really? That's good for Wall Street and great for Scott Brown. But it doesn't make sense for New Hampshire. Senate Majority PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
From the top, that was Democratic State Representative Cindy Rosenwald on the House's vote this week to extend Medicaid coverage to a wider group of Granite Staters. Senior Assistant Attorney General James Buffetti on the state's investigation of troubles at the Fred Fuller Oil Company. Karen Savasco, co-founder of Gate City Charter School for the Arts, on a vote this week to give these alternative public schools more money. Claudia Barrett, owner of CQ Coffee Roasters in Bedford, which a national coffee publication recently ranked as one of the nation's best, and the first Democratic super PAC ad against Scott Brown for U.S. Senate, even though he's yet to say whether he's going to make a run representing the Granite State. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and as we review the week's top stories, let's hear from you. The number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. Our guests on the roundup this week are Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
And as always, Dean Spiliotis is here, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, the legislature reconvened this week for the second year of its two-year session. And wow, Norma, they didn't waste any time over there on the House side. What were some of the big votes that they took right away?
I think probably the biggest vote was on Medicaid. You had Cindy Rosenwald on your lead-in. And unfortunately for the House, they passed a bill that has caused the Senate Republicans to get very angry. We're pretty much picking up where we left off in November at the special session. The House passed a bill over. Very similar to this one. This one stepped back a little bit. It said the poorest adults, those who have incomes of 0 to 100% of poverty, they want them to stay on the state's Medicaid managed care system and not, as originally was proposed, to go through the marketplace and have private insurance after a transition time. The reaction in the Senate was, you know, we're already talking about this amongst ourselves. This doesn't help things.
You jumped in too soon, they said.
Correct. And I think what the House wanted was to send a bill over to have a bill there that could be amended. They could fast track it, get it out in the next weeks, months, rather than have to introduce a new bill and put it all the way through the system. But they already have a new bill introduced in the House that will take that, go through that whole process. House Republicans wanted there to be a hearing. But there are negotiations that have been going on since the end of the special session in the Senate to try and find a solution. It's the Senate that has to come up with an agreement on this, or nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting, Norma, just picking up on what you said, Dean Spiliotis, a lot of the coverage of this wasn't on so much what the House did, but when they did it and how they did it. Why is that?
Well, we just went through this special session in the fall in which there was a sense that a compromise was very close, but they didn't actually reach one. You know, we've talked about this for months now, and I'm someone who has been very skeptical about the likelihood that they can easily reach an agreement on this. I think there's a fundamental disagreement about, how to undertake the expansion. Do you do it in part through the managed care system, or do you get a waiver from the federal government and let people buy money in these health exchanges? And I have not seen a lot of movement on that. You know, for me, the political strategy here in introducing this bill right off the top, I understand Norma's point about, you know, facilitating eventual compromise in the Senate.
So get it started early.
Yeah, but there's a political risk here because it seems like a pressure tactic. A number of Democrats have been kind of critical about the inability to reach a compromise in the fall. But I do think it's going to come down to something from the Senate. But when I heard that they were going to do this, you know, it's a risk because it runs the risk of kind of irritating Republicans in the Senate who feel like they're being pressured. You know, to me, it feels a little bit like potentially a step back in terms of the compromise process.
Jeff, go ahead.
I think when you bring up the politics, there's really something interesting about this is that, you know, it's really an issue that is close to the governor's heart. She's really big on this. And as we know, she will be running for re-election this year. And I think that this is part of the whole picture here. Is that the Democrats think they have an issue, whether they get a compromise or not, they have an issue that plays well for them in the elections coming up. I think they have the Republicans on something. I'm not sure that the Republicans are going to bite on this, but I do think that there's pressure is on the Republicans to compromise.
Well, and it's good that you said that, Jeff, because a lot of the stuff that we're going to see happening in the State House this year is going to be colored by those 2014 elections,
absolutely.
Right? Well, you can join us on this Medicaid vote and other topics that caught your attention in the news this week. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And folks, we won't run through all the bills that will be before the legislature over the next 6 months, but a couple other big ones that came up this week, Norma.
I think there are two other ones that probably got a lot of debate. In 1996, we lowered the age when we treated our 17-year-olds as adults automatically when they were accused of crimes. And this was largely because Massachusetts and other states had done this. There was a feeling that if they sent drug mules or people carrying drugs into New Hampshire, they'd be treated as juveniles instead of adults. So we lowered our age. Prosecutors can petition the court and always have been able to charge teens with adult crimes.
So there's some flexibility there.
Correct.
If it's deemed
warranted.
But
it was
warranted.
A process. So now the move in the country, there are like 40 states that have 18 as the cutoff point, and New Hampshire is considering raising it. We have room at the reformatory. We call it the Sununu Center in Manchester. There are lots of beds down there. In fact, their question during the budget was, we have so much staff, but the population has dropped. So that's one big issue. Another issue is charter schools. There are people pushing to give charter schools more money, particularly since they don't get the same support necessarily. If a local school district doesn't form the charter school, then they don't get the property tax support that a school that, you know,
that are approved by the local boards.
Right.
Yeah, these are the state-approved charter schools, and they've had a little bit more of a funding
struggle.
And
there's been this issue that charter schools have had to go before the state board to get approval because there's been resistance locally. So they get each pupil per adequate education aid, which is about $3,500. And then on top of that, the legislature voted to give them $2,000. So they get about $5,500 on average. If you're a student in a public school, you would get that base aid, and you get about $1,750. If you're a poor kid who gets a subsidized lunch, so the average there is also about $5,000 or so. But the cost of education is over $13,000 on average, and so with this proposal would do is say, let's give charter schools 50% of whatever that average is, so they'd get maybe $1,200 more than they're getting now.
And they've struggled, and we've talked about this on this program before, but in the last couple of years, Jeff Feingold, it seems like they have taken a foothold in some communities.
I know when they first were proposed, there was a lot of resistance in a lot of communities. I know actually I lived in one where they have attempted for years to have one, and we haven't approved it. But they have taken off, and they've been in some ways very successful. Others, there's been some problems. It's still, by New Hampshire standard, you know, compared to some other states, it's still an experiment, ongoing experiment in education in New Hampshire, and the jury's still out on whether it's working or not.
So this is always the issue: is the money, yeah. Who's going to pay for it, and
yes,
so forth.
Yes, well, as it is in education in New Hampshire, that's always the topic.
Yeah, I want to ask you about one more bill that caught my attention, Dean Spiliotis. A bill defining push polling passed. Now, just what is push polling, and why is it considered a bad thing? Why did the House feel the need to address it?
Sure, you know, push polling is a technique often used in campaigns. It's a version of a telemarketing technique in which you're not so much concerned with analyzing the responses to the survey, you're really interested in influencing the views or opinions of the people who take the survey. So, you know, for example, you might get a phone call that says, you know, how do you feel about candidate X? And then you'll be told, what if I told you that candidate X has been late on his or her income tax payments for the last 3 years? How would that make you feel? So there's all kinds of sort of scurrilous stuff that can kind of be brought up as a means of informing voters about, you know, potential unsavory issues with a candidate. And so, you know, every campaign, there are the campaigns and some of the independent groups point fingers at each other and say, you know, it's not legitimate polling, it's push polling. So, well, you know, what the legislature is trying to do here is kind of define the minimum threshold for push polling. So for a major race, say a congressional race, you'd have to have 2,000 connected calls that last than 2 minutes. And then they have lower thresholds in the hundreds for smaller races. So they're just trying to sort of codify this a little bit because, you know, the part and parcel of the political dynamic in a race is people accusing each other of push polling. But they can be pretty insidious and bring up some pretty scurrilous stuff if they're not monitored.
All right. A lot more conversation after a short break, including some of the controversy surrounding the Fred Fuller Heating Oil Company. We'll also talk about the polar vortex that hit the Granite State this week. All that coming up. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. And more of the Friday News Roundup coming up on The Exchange. Then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, it's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. If you want to know what's going on at NHPR this week, we have an easy way for you to find out. Just sign up for our e-newsletter this week at NHPR. You'll find out what The Exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week. Also, get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. Cloudy today with high temperatures upper 20s to lower 30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations online at centrixbank.com. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth presenting Guitar Passion, an evening of Latin, Brazilian, and jazz guitar music Thursday, February 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week, and we'd love to hear from you. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Well, Norma Love, Dean Spiliotis, Jeff Feingold, I wanted to follow up on a story that made headlines every day this week. And Jeff, I'll turn to you first, since you are with the New Hampshire Business Review. The Hassan administration had to respond to a big fear among some Granite Staters that they might not have enough heating oil in the middle of a super cold snap. This is the Fred Fuller Company, been around for a long time, not some fly-by-night operation. What happened with Fred Fuller Oil Company?
I think they're still trying to figure that out, aren't they? I mean, it's what happened was that they just weren't able to make their deliveries, and the most concerning thing was customers tried reaching them, and they couldn't reach the company to complain. Actually, I'll have to say that I even got some complaints sent to me about the company because we give out these Bob Awards, Best of Business, and Fred Fuller has won a couple of them. and people saying, this is the best of business, and I send a link to it. But anyway, but it's one of the largest fuel dealers in the state. It's been a it's something that's apparently never happened to the company before, and there's really not a clear explanation. They said it was the phone system, but Fairpoint said nothing was wrong with the phone system, and it's a kind of a complicated thing. The attorney general's looking into it, and it's not quite clear why this is happening, because they have. Judging by these Bob Awards they've won, they've had pretty good customer service.
Sure, a long track record.
And all of a sudden, the thing happened. But I do have to say another thing is that they're not particularly well-loved in the heating oil industry in the state. And part of the fallout of this is that they're losing customers. And I know that many of those competitors are pretty happy that they're taking customers away from food.
Well, the timing was terrible, of course, because of the cold snap this week.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk about that in
Absolutely.
Just a minute. But Norma Love, you've got some personal experience with this story.
Yes. I'm a pre-buy customer, and I'll probably be calling them middle of next week and see if I'm going to be one of the ones that has to call the hotline because we're getting low. But there was a bill in the legislature that got pulled off the consent calendar Wednesday. It was scheduled to be killed, and it probably will still be killed. The legislature has struggled for years on how to protect pre-buy customers, because you will give, like we did last January, you will sign a contract and you'll fork out a couple $1,000s and say, I want X number of gallons to cover me for the next winter. But there's no protection for you to get your money back, and there's nothing that
if
says—
If they don't deliver the oil.
Right, and there's nothing that really says— I mean, you're basically buying oil at— we got it, and one of the reasons, as Jeff said, they're not liked in the industry is that they have a pretty low price, lower than a lot of the other companies. They're also larger than a lot of the other companies. So you have this contract, but there's no guarantee you're going to get it back. And over the last few years, we've had some oil companies that have gone out of business, and people have gotten stuck and lost thousands and thousands of dollars.
Okay, Jeff,
almost,
go ahead.
It has, in recent years, almost seemed to happen every year. But it's never happened on this kind of a scale with a company this large. Usually it's
with
more
other companies.
With other oil companies, and usually they're smaller, and it's less of more of a regional effect.
Yeah, and Norma mentioned this hotline, Dean. Governor Hassan set up a hotline to help folks out with this.
Yeah, I found this really interesting from a political perspective. I've talked many times in the past about how one of the key roles of any governor is to be able to deal with natural disasters, weather-related crises, other types of crises in the state. I've referred to it as, you know, being able to wear the windbreaker. and what's so interesting to me this time is, you know, the imagery of, you know, Governor Hassan talking about a 24-hour hotline that, in fairness, has received over 1,000 calls. You know, she had a little bit of a command center kind of visual going there. And this is essentially a private marketplace issue, yet she was able to key in very quickly on sort of the kind of personal danger, health, senior citizens, freezing aspect of it. And I think it was very smart politically. It was good visuals for them. And it sounds like it was useful for over 1,000 people. But yeah, I mean, she managed to kind of turn this into sort of a public health crisis in a way because of the temperatures.
Well, people sometimes say, as you said, Dean, yes. That it's important for a governor to wear the windbreaker.
Yes, absolutely.
People often said Governor Lynch wore the rain jacket, right? Remember all those floods that he went to?
And nothing
he
will,
was elected four times.
Yeah, so, nothing will end a political career quicker than not responding to these kinds
exactly.
of problems.
All right. Well, as we said, this did not happen at a good time because New Hampshire was gripped by what was called a polar vortex this week. That made headlines earlier in the week. With us now on the phone is Mary Stampone. She's New Hampshire's state climatologist and a professor of geography at UNH. And Mary Stampone, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, it was fun just to say the words polar vortex on the air. My goodness, that's a pretty catchy phrase. What is it?
The term polar vortex simply refers to the upper level atmospheric circulation pattern that is centered at the pole. It forms in response to the temperature difference between the polar regions and the middle latitudes, and it results in a zone of generally west-to-east upper-level wind that typically separates the very cold, frigid polar air to our north and the more moderate mid-latitude air that we typically refer to as, you know, sort of our general weather patterns.
How common are they in northern New England?
Well, the polar vortex is always there.
I see.
And
but this convergence, I guess, is that's what
I'm
asking.
Yeah, and what's been making the headlines is the wave pattern in the circulation, we've seen a very wavy jet stream that has allowed that cold polar air to migrate further south than it typically does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been giving us these abnormally cold temperatures.
Were any records broken in New Hampshire on Monday night or Tuesday, Mary?
Most of them were broken overnight Tuesday into Wednesday. For we had numerous daily records broken for daytime or lowest daytime highs on Wednesday. But so far, we have not seen any sort of, you know, monthly records broken or all-time records broken for January.
I have another question for you, Mary, and this comes from an email that just came in from Rob, who says, my favorite part of the polar vortex overcoverage, sorry, Rob, if you think we're overcovering it, was the attempt to blame global warming for the fact that we were all freezing to death. Rob says, this from the same folks that, when it was shown that recent data did not support actual warming of the Earth, changed the campaign to climate change. He says, it's also the same folks who many years ago were trumpeting global cooling. You know, there were some folks this week, Mary, who said, hey, look at this extremely cold weather. This disproves climate change and the fact that many believe the world's temperatures are getting warmer. What do you think?
I mean, they're comparing apples and oranges. You can't use, you know, a 2 to 3 day weather event in one part of the world to characterize Earth's global climate system and how it's changed over the course of decades or more. So what, you know, it's not really, it's not appropriate to use this in support of or against the idea of global warming. This is, you know, this is a weather pattern. In any kind of general sense, you know, we're looking at trends in climate to describe climate change, not individual weather events, especially ones that are happening in one part of the world. At the same time, you know, we're seeing record-breaking heat in Australia. Parts of Eastern Europe are actually above normal in terms of their winter temperatures, while we're below normal. So it's just really not an appropriate characterization.
Okay, Mary, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
That's Mary Stampone, New Hampshire State Climatologist, Assistant Professor of Geography at UNH. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today on The Exchange. And all of you, we always like to spend a few minutes each week on politics. It is indeed a midterm election year, as we said earlier. Jeff Feingold, Hotline, a nationally well-regarded source of political analysis, had something to say this week about New Hampshire. What did the folks at Hotline say, Jeff?
Yeah, they had their usual, they have a regular series of articles looking at which congressional districts that they say are the most flippable, which means they go from one party to the other. And they've listed the first district in New Hampshire, which is Carol Shea Porter's district, as the 12th most flippable state.
Wow, that's pretty high.
And or race. And yeah, and it seemed pretty high, but if you read their description, it didn't seem they were talking about the weaknesses of Frank Ginta. They didn't even mention Dan Innes, by the way.
Yeah, there's a primary,
which
on
is
the
a
Republican
primary
side.
On the Republican side, and he mentioned Frank Ginta's weaknesses, the former congressman, and she said, and they said, well, she might not be, she might be pretty safe here, but implied that she might have been safe, but they said it was 12th. And Congresswoman Custer, her district, the second district, was ranked as the somewhere in the 20s, I believe it was 24 or something, 24th most flippable, and it's interesting. I mean, it is New Hampshire, and you know they and. You know, we've had these seats have been going from one party to the other, as
they
we know.
They sure have flipped, right.
And it's pretty safe to say they are should be on the list of most flippable. But, you know, we don't know. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see, especially I'm interested more in the second district because I think that there might be some kind of change there. I don't know. I mean, it seems that Congresswoman Custer has maybe a little bit more vulnerable over there than
yeah.
she might have seemed a year or so ago.
Dean, what do you think about this? Nationally, New Hampshire is seen as a battleground state in these congressional districts.
Right. And, you know, the Hotline is a venerable institution. I enjoy reading it. But, you know, this is no great surprise to me. You know, when you look at the House of Representatives, because of redistricting and kind of the political demographics of the country, you're typically only looking at 50 or 60 seats in total being in play. So to be ranked 20 something out of 50 or 60 is really not that unusual. And as Jeff said, both of those districts have swung back and forth over the last 10 years. You know, the first CD, we've gone from Jeb Bradley to Carol Shea Porter to Frank Ginta and back to Carol Shea Porter. The second CD, we've gone from Charlie Bass to Paul Hodes, back to Charlie Bass to Annie Custer. I mean, these seats have been in play for a long time. And as I've said before, they really are, in a sense, kind of tied into larger political currents in the country. So if this turns out to be a bad year for Democrats, then maybe they'll be in trouble. If it turns out to be an okay year for Democrats in the state, they'll probably hold the seat. You know, there has been some chatter out there that, you know, Annie Custer's in a little bit of trouble. I think she's certainly had some public relations and communications problems so far in her term. But we'll see. And again, you know, I think in many respects, these two seats have less to do with the specifics of the representatives and kind of more to do with sort of larger political currents in the state. And, you know, to hear that they're both flippable, you know, is not a great surprise to me.
Kind of like what Mary Stampone says, it gets cold in the wintertime.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We'd love to hear from you about some of the stories that caught your attention this week, from the reconvening of the legislature, dealing with bills from juvenile punishment to Medicaid expansion. We've also talked about the cold weather this week. Later on, we'll talk about some of the more interesting stories in the cultural side of life here in New Hampshire, including a coffee roaster receiving some national recognition. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And Dean, I want to ask you about the U.S. Senate race, but hear from everybody else as well. As everyone knows, Jean Shaheen is up for re-election. Last week, we played an anti-Jean Shaheen ad, taking her to task for supporting the Affordable Care Act. This week, Dean, a group called Senate Majority PAC is airing an anti-Scott Brown ad, even though the former Massachusetts U.S. Senator isn't officially in the race. Why are they doing this?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's almost more interesting for what it says about the Republican Party in the state rather than the actual race. But I'll talk about that in a moment. Yes, this Senate Majority PAC, which is a PAC run by former aides to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, they did about $150,000 ad by basically accusing Scott Brown of shopping for a Senate seat in New Hampshire. So they're kind of striking back because Jean Shaheen has been under fire in recent weeks. But the more interesting story is Scott Brown a couple days ago penned a fundraising letter. Scathing letter against Jean Shaheen and her liberal allies in Washington, as the fundraising letter put it. But it was interesting. It was released through the state Republican Party and went out to the media through the New Hampshire state email system for the party. So some conservatives were upset that, you know, this is, you know, they're anointing Scott Brown the nominee.
And they're not supposed to do that.
No, the party said, well, you know, anybody can do this, but the timing is a little bit curious. So, you know, for me, the kind of internal dynamics within the GOP in the state is almost more interesting than what they're doing with Jean Shaheen at the moment. And some of the reporting said that, you know, Scott Brown will probably announce that he's running within a month. I'd be interested to know who the source is there, but certainly no shortage of speculation.
Norma, what do you make of this? Advertising against a guy who isn't even running yet.
Well, I think they're going to ride that horse until it isn't there anymore. I mean, he's got to make a decision at some point. And when he does, if he decides to run, that changes the whole dynamic. Then you have the party, as Dean was saying, being accused of picking its own horses to ride. And there are already other people who are running in that race. Jim Rubens, Karen Testerman, and
possibly
Bob Smith. So the party powers that be, if they decide, well, those guys aren't good enough, we got to pick somebody else, that doesn't always set well. And I wonder if the rank and file, there are already enough divisions within that big tent that would not surprise me that there might be a little more if this turns out to be a Scott Brown anointment.
Because, again, the party's not supposed to rally behind anybody.
Correct.
Until after the primary. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
It really can be a big can of worms that they might be opening up here. The interesting thing is that, you know, there's a certain segment of the party that thinks that they want to have Scott Brown, but there are others who are very, very much opposed to him. And I know that it seems to me, I'm just... No, this is like kind of like Kremlin watching, but at the end of the year, the union leader named Jim Rubins its Citizen of the Year.
Yeah, we talked about that last week.
Yeah, which is, you know, obviously saying making a statement of some kind.
About who
that,
the union leader might
yeah,
support.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. 1-800-892-6477, again, is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. One more local political story that I wanted to ask you all about. Jeff, I'll start with you. Ted Gatzis was inaugurated as mayor of Manchester this week for a third term. Queen City has 100,000 residents, so we thought it was worth noting. A lot of New Hampshire people who live there. What are some of the issues before the mayor? What did he talk about at
his inauguration? Well, it was interesting, as compared to previous inaugural, he talked a lot about education in previous inaugurals, but this time it was really the focus was on crime. And that's an issue. And I know NHPR has done a series on crime in Manchester last year that you did that. And it's an issue that's very much at the forefront in the city. I work in Manchester, and it's something that's discussed a lot. There's been, I think they mentioned 300 burglaries last year, which is a lot. It's like almost one a day. And there's been several really serious armed robberies and other kinds of just nasty, mostly drug-related, it seems, crime that's happening. And that's really become the focus of this term for him. You know, he wants to increase the number of police and all that. The interesting thing is it kind of raises a question to me. You know, I know, as dean, we're going to talk a little bit about the politics of this, is that it does raise a point about why the mayor of Manchester, except for in case of Frank Ginta, has very little chance of getting an office beyond being mayor of Manchester.
Although Ted Gatz is a former state senator.
He's a former senator.
And a prominent state senator.
But in terms of becoming a statewide, governor or something, it's because, there are issues that they have to deal with in Manchester that really are really just nothing like in most parts of the state, because it's the biggest city.
Sure.
It's a much more diverse city. There's so much going on. And if you stay there long enough, you end up upsetting people, alienating people, or saying, what the heck, the streets aren't plowed, or all that kind of stuff. It's an interesting dynamic, because if you go down the list of it, mayors of Manchester very rarely move on successfully in New Hampshire statewide politics.
Yeah, what do you think, Dean?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You know, this is Ted Gatzis' third term. Democrats were a little bit more competitive this time than they were in the past. He talked a bit about economic development and about education, things that mayors typically talk about, but he did segue very quickly to this issue of crime and about the need for more foot patrols and community watch groups. It is a big problem. I don't have an overall sense of how it compares to the last couple of years, but anybody who watches television news or reads the newspapers, it seems like there's been an uptick in burglaries, bank robberies, armed robberies, just sort of bad stuff, and he clearly needs to deal with it.
All right. Well, after a short break, we'll shift our attention from electoral politics to what may happen with the Northern Pass Project in 2014. All that and some other stories coming up. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, on the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, both political parties focus on income inequality. The Supreme Court halts same-sex marriage in Utah, then former NBA players make a controversial trip to North Korea. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Vineyard Brands, importers of Wars Otima 10-year-old Tawny Port, now available at all New Hampshire state liquor stores, vineyardbrands.com. And Menadnar Corps is presenting a Lithuanian Christmas with ethnic dancers and traditional music January 11th at 4 p.m. at the Peterborough Townhouse. Tickets at menadnar-chorus.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, the law school blues. Law school enrollments are plummeting and jobs are scarce for new graduates. We'll find out more on Monday. Email us your thoughts before the program to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word, and join us Monday morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call. We want your thoughts, comments, questions about some of the headlines that caught your attention this week. 1-800-892-6477. And Norma Love, I wanted to open this segment of the show by asking you about the Northern Pass. I have heard that 2014 could be a big year for this hydropower project. Weather legislation, regulatory deadlines, approvals. Just give us a little preview if you could, Norma.
Well, I think right now it's in the hands of the U.S. Department of Energy. They held hearings this fall on the project, and they have to issue an environmental impact statement. And then after that's issued, I'm sure there'll be more comments. But the final review comes down to the state site evaluation committee. So it's going to be a while because you have to go through these processes to get there. I don't even think the Northern Pass folks think they'll start construction, for at least a year or two. But on the legislative side, there's still action. There's still people who say, you know, we've got to do something to make sure they bury the lines. Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley is thinking about or is proposing a bill that would require, unless, you know, it's not feasible for big projects like this to bury their lines, and that would include, I think, pipelines, because there's some question about natural gas pipelines.
He's tying that to highway funding, right? Bury them along highway rights of way and take the money to
instead of a gas tax hike. And I think that might take an awful lot of a long time to get money in to repair the road. So I'm not sure that that's going to be an immediate fix for roads. The House has got a bill before it to act on this month that is similar, but it's a little bit more mandatory, I guess I would say. I mean, even Jeb gives it a little bit of an out. But they're saying if it's, it would be preferable to bury the lines. So there's more thinking along that lines. The governor is supportive of burying more miles of the lines. I think there's only like 7 or 8 miles that the project is proposing to bury.
Right.
To preserve the natural vistas. And one of the big pushes is that this power is not directly going to New Hampshire, although the project says indirectly New Hampshire would benefit. It's really going to southern New England. And so we're saying, hey, if you're going to send this power south, New Hampshire should get something out of it. And I think that's where Jeb Bradley's coming from and some of the House members.
So there'll be some regulatory hurdles, whether it's Department of Energy or New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee. There'll be some legislation. There'll be some action on this year, Norma.
There'll be action this year. I'm not sure how far it will go.
Yeah.
Jeff. As a state that went through Seabrook for forever, I think we have a long, long way to go on this because it's just especially because the opposition in the North Country remains very, very steadfast against it. It'll be interesting to see how we progress, whether there is any progress this year. I mean, there will be some, but each time there'll be challenges and there'll be roadblocks, attempts at roadblocks being put up. It's got a long road to hoe.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this because, you know, I've studied sort of regulatory processes in other contexts. And, someone asked me just last week because they read that there was like a June 2017 up and running date. And they said, is that a firm date? And I said, I have no idea. I don't have a sense yet of the extent to which the legislature can kind of slow this down or stop it with some of these bills about burying the lines. There may be opportunities for legal action.
Yes.
Then that will send it into the courts
absolutely.
For years. So, I mean, it's just the whole nature of, even though the regulatory process is kind of chugging along, the whole nature of the discussion seems to be hypothetical because once sort of politics is injected into this, it could really bring it to a standstill.
Norma.
And I think people, even the project managers would agree that the site evaluation committee does have some say in issuing a permit and whether that would be challenged if they said, oh, you have to bury X number of miles of the lines. They could set requirements on this project that as project might not like or could delay it, as Dean and Jeff have pointed out.
I've got a couple emails I want to share with all of you, and I also want to remind you that you can still join us at 1-800-892-6477 on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in from Christopher in Manchester. He says, I think the first congressional district would be more vulnerable to flipping than the second if a moderate moderate were to run in the second, they might have a chance. But the current crop of Republicans seems a bit conservative for that district. Thanks, Christopher, for the email. And let's deal with both of the districts that he's talking about. First of all, Dean Spiliotis, he thinks the first CD is more vulnerable to flipping than the second. What do you think?
Well, we've heard that argument for a number of years based on kind of the sort of the political demographics of the two districts. You know, the first CD supposedly leans a little bit more Republican than the second CD, which includes, you know, the Upper Valley and the western part of the state, which is increasingly Democratic.
Keene, Hanover.
Yes, the sort of Democratic areas, Concord as well. So, you know, that's been kind of the conventional wisdom. You know, I think it's in general true, but I also think Carl Shea Porter has kind of been able to beat the odds on several occasions now.
Yeah.
So I think it's more than just the demographics. But yeah, the conventional wisdom. I think there are some differences in the districts, but there's a lot that can kind of upend that conventional wisdom.
Yeah, she has been Congresswoman Porter. Shea Porter has actually, you know, she's been really very strong on a lot of issues that are important that are not just, you know, progressive liberal issues, especially working with veterans and things. And that's, you know, people know that in her district. She's not, you know, this woman who came out of nowhere several years ago when she first ran.
To Christopher's second point, if a moderate were to run in the second, and I'm assuming he's talking about a Republican, because he goes on to say they might have a chance, but the current crop of Republicans seems a bit conservative for that district. What about the second district and Christopher's thoughts there, Norma?
I think that that's a good point, because you have fairly conservative people lining up to run in that district. And it's always, as Dean pointed out, in general, lean more Democratic. But Annie Custer is pretty liberal. So, you know, you have a fairly liberal and you have some really conservative. So if you had someone like Charlie Bass was more of a moderate Republican, and I think that's why he managed to win that district more than once.
All right. Well, thanks for the email, Christopher. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. Here's one that came in earlier from Seth. He says, I saw a news clip of the governor speaking about tourism, teaming up with the beer industry and local brewers to promote New Hampshire's tourism and economic development. Maybe we can start to catch up with Vermont and Maine. Granite State ingenuity, love it. Now, Dean, the local breweries had a really good year last year.
Yeah, and it's part of a larger trend, I think, nationally. It's, you know, microbrewing has been kind of a popular thing for many years now, and it seems like there are a number of these enterprises in New Hampshire that are getting some attention and catching on. And sure, you know, any angle to boost tourism, you know, why not? There are people who, you know, go to Vermont to take a tour of the Long Trail factory or the Magic Hat factory up in Burlington. So why not do that in New Hampshire?
Yeah. Actually, you know, we've done stories in the Business Review about this. The growth in the brewery business in New Hampshire has been really pretty amazing. It's about over 30 of them now, breweries and brew pubs in the state. And it's an effort to put all of them on this map and put New Hampshire on the map when it comes to beer making. But in a way, we are already, because we already have this gigantic Anheuser-Busch brewery in Merrimack. Red Hook has a brewery in Pease, and that's one of the major craft brewing companies in the United States. And also Smutty Nose, a locally born business, you know, that came out of the Portsmouth brewery. That's a very, very, very successful craft brew company. And now we have these smaller breweries, and it's really just a matter of getting the word out, which I guess apparently what the governor is trying to do with this effort.
Well, and Seth, thanks for the email, because it gets us into a story that I wanted to ask you folks about anyway. And this is a business story, so I'm going to turn to you again, Jeff. CQ Coffee Roasters in Bedford. We've talked about, you know, specialty beer. This is specialty coffee. It has a blend that was ranked by the magazine Coffee Review as fifth best in the nation. Fifth best in the nation. Not bad.
And I have to say, I've never had the coffee, but I'm eager to try it now because, you know, it's something that really says something about New Hampshire. New Hampshire is the economy of New Hampshire has so many small businesses, so many little places that are really have something of an impact nationally. I made the mention of Smutty Nose, which was a little company which has become bigger because of it. But this is a perfect example of just New Hampshire, of a New Hampshire business that probably most people hadn't heard of until this thing came out. That's been chugging along and getting a national reputation for the product it produces. It's really encouraging about New Hampshire that we're still able to have this entrepreneurial benefits.
Yeah, it's part of this whole foodie entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
Well, and the web has made it. The web has been a huge innovation because now this little company in Bedford is getting orders from all over the country for this. I think it was a Kenyan peaberry roast.
Yeah.
And you can start something up in your garage and you find an audience through the internet and you're in business.
All right.
Well, that's how Sanders Associates started. So it became BAE Systems.
Let's take another call. And I've got another email too here for you. And Bill is calling from Manchester. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Laura. This is Bill. I love your show. I have 2 points. One is on the polar vortex, and I love the fact that these media outlets will put out something about how it disproves global warming or disproves climate change with one or two data points. I'd like your panelists to talk briefly about how I consider it irresponsible journalism to take essentially one or two data points, and as your previous speaker spoke to it, and turn it into scientific fact or scientific refutation rather than looking at long-term trends, and how a disservice and how irresponsible the journalism behind that is to our educational system.
Yeah, and Mary Stampone helped us out with that story, Bill. Go ahead. What was your other point?
The other point is Scott Brown is an interesting guy in the sense that regardless of what your political views are, you consider the fact that you're born in the wrong state, if you will, in his case, a moderate conservative born in a very liberal state, and he's got a passion for what he wants to articulate. What is really wrong with moving to another state to try and find a place as a platform for your voice and passion if people are aligned with your views? You know, this whole carpetbagging thing, Hillary Clinton moved to New York. You know, is there anything really wrong with that when here's a talented person? We need talented people in the Senate, regardless of what your political viewpoints are. What's wrong with going to the right state to find a place to launch your career?
Bill, good to hear from you. And he's right, Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, sure.
Hillary Clinton did it.
Sure. I mean, on both points, actually, you know, the polar vortex, you know, if you watch any of the satires like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, they did some great satire of the media reporting on the polar vortex. You know, I lived in Chicago for many years, and I just remember being really cold, right? It's interesting to see all the, you know, a lot of the fuss now. It was always really cold in the winter there. On Scott Brown, you know, I have someone who has talked about the carpetbagger issue. You know, the issue for me is not so much how long he's been here, but whether or not he's been part of the political discourse in the state. And he just has not been until now. We don't, you know, we've had years of discussions about politics in New Hampshire, and he's just not been a particularly a central part of that discussion, if at all. So,
but Hillary Clinton wasn't a part of the political discourse in New York, right?
Jeff, you want to jump in?
I just want to say that New York has much more of a tradition of allowing, of embracing people from outside.
You know, really?
Hillary Clinton, yeah, well, Bobby Kennedy is a perfect example of a senator. He just moved into New York, and I want to be senator.
And she's a somewhat unusual case, too.
Yeah, but also New York it's just a different state. New Hampshire politics is much different.
Right.
And Republican Party in New Hampshire, especially today, is not the same as like the Republican Party in Massachusetts. It's a much more conservative party, and I don't think he will be welcomed with open arms by a lot of people in the party.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call, Bill. Thank you very much. And I wanted to ask all of you about a more cultural story, an unusual event going on at the Seacoast Repertory Theater. I'm going to read a little bit and then ask you all about it. It's an interesting – this is from Seacoast Online. It says, here's an interesting premise for a film. A lonely 14-year-old gay boy becomes pen pals with a 23-year-old female who's a convicted killer. The fact that it is based on real life makes it all the more interesting. This is a series of letters between Pamela Smart, who, Norma, I'm going to ask you to refresh our memories on that, and a gentleman who exchanged letters with her, Chris Bradley, who's an actor, in the 90s when he was going through that, you know, tough teenage time. He's now made this into sort of a drama piece. It's going to be made into a film. It's gotten a lot of attention over on the Seacoast. Norma, just remind us, though, about the basis of this Pam Smart case and what makes this theater piece so unusual.
Well, I mean, she was worked for a school, and there were young men in that school that she befriended, that she was convicted of encouraging or getting to kill her husband.
It was murder. She paid them to kill her husband.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I think one of the young men thought he was in love with her.
Well, they had some kind of a relationship. I have to say, I covered part of that trial. And at the time,
I see, Jeff. Okay, I should have asked you.
And it was really a disturbing case. It was her husband was brutally murdered by these boys at the time they were boys, and it was something that gripped the nation actually, if there was if there were media from around the world covering this trial, people who were around who remember that at the time, it was so sensational because there was a relationship with one of the boys, and it was like something that doesn't happen in New Hampshire, and I've read the article about this, and it sounds interesting, but it's the kind of thing where, you know, if you live in California and see it, you'll have a different reaction to a film like this than if you live in New Hampshire. I have no idea what the Smart family thinks about Greg Smart's family thinks about this. I would imagine they're not too thrilled by the
idea.
And
again, it's not so much about the murder. It's about the letters that this, you know, troubled young boy going through that typical tough teenage time wrote to her in prison and her letters back. So it's interesting. Okay, well, I didn't realize you'd covered that, Jeff, so thank you.
Been around long enough.
Yeah. I wanted to ask all of you what you'll be watching next week. And Norma, how about you first? What are you going to be tracking next week in terms of the news?
There's three things. On Tuesday, I hear that the Senate is going to have two hearings. One is going to be on David Waters' bill on mental health issues and having people who are adjudicated of mental illness reported to the National Crime Database, so when there's a background check, they would show up.
The mental health and guns bill.
We're one of 11 states that doesn't do it. Second one is a domestic violence bill, and the mother of the 9-year-old who was killed at the Y is going to testify.
Wow.
And third is legalizing marijuana for recreational use.
Yes, and I got an email about that from Stefan that I did not have time to read. So Stefan will be on it, promise, just not this week. Jeff, how about you?
Yeah, I'm going to be focusing at least the next couple of weeks, if not the rest of the session, on this whole issue of income inequality. You know, we're talking about minimum wage increases and things, and it's an issue that's not going national. It's also being discussed in New Hampshire. And Hedrick Smith will be here on, I think, the 22nd in Laconia to discuss his book on this. It's going to be it's something that's going to be a part of the definitely the political debate this year.
All right. We had Hedrick Smith on the show a couple months back talking about that. Dean, super quick to you.
Sure. One eye on the midterm races that are heating up and one eye on kind of the local politics surrounding Medicaid. And I think the gas tax road issue is not going to go away.
All right. We've got Chris Clement next week on the show, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation, on Tuesday. So more on that on Tuesday. Thank you all for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, why more young people are ruling against law school. Enrollment numbers are way down and schools are worried. Then Department of Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement on his increasingly vocal concern about his agency's funding. And in a series of articles in The Atlantic, one Granite State activist examines the state of American poverty 50 years after President Johnson famously declared war on it. Join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show and the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Littleton Regional Healthcare, sending best wishes for a happy holiday season and healthy new year, littletonhealthcare.org. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The jobs report this morning is being called weird and wacky. The U.S. economy added just 74,000 jobs last month, but the unemployment rate fell as fewer people sought work. Senate Democrats hit a snag in their plan to extend long-term